Well, some of you will be thinking, she's not Satyajit. You're right. But it's my pleasure to introduce Satyajit today. Some of you will know him, I'm sure. I've known Satyajit, for decades now, really, really decades, since really the launch of Buddhafield. It's very early days, when he wasn't actually Satyajit then. He had another name. And so I've seen Satyajit, known him for all this time throughout my work in Buddhafield, and I can say, hand on heart, never has there been such a man for working indefatigably for what he believes in, with great sincerity, with great commitment, and with great love. So I feel especially privileged to be able to be here today to hear his talk and to introduce him. And I'll so hand over now. Thank you, Satyajit.
Thank you very much. Badri. Okay. I think the title of this talk is something like Awakening to the Earth, or Awakening to the Green Earth, an inconceivably vast undertaking, which is a bit of a pun and a nod to people who are in the know. So I'll get going in a moment. The only thing I want to say is I don't seem to have marshalled all my thoughts into a linear fashion. I've got a sense of kind of my notes go round and then round and round again, and I've decided to be okay with that. So if you wonder why, if there's an element of that going on, well, that's just how it is. I can't really see a problem with that, really. After a while, I thought, there we go. Yeah. Okay. So when you step on the earth, when you put your ear to the ground, when you dig your hand into the soil, when you look up into the branches of a tree, what is it that you find? What is it you find when you try to awaken to the earth? And these are just some of my own flights of fancy around that. I'm not saying this is what goes on for all of us. But I wonder, do you see flowers reaching up for the blue sky? Or do you have memories of a cold, windy field and a ritual last night? Do you have memories of other times when the rain was pouring down, mud over your wellies, and the rain soaking into your trousers? But do you see things growing, or do you look down into the soil, into when it's wet and bleak, and do you see little bugs or worms finding a home, finding a life, where you couldn't imagine finding a life? You just want to get out of there and go to somewhere warm. And when you're here now, do you find you're enjoying the days of the spring that have finally come after the winter? And it's been so much rain and so much cold, and I think it's been a very long, hard, wet winter, and a long, wet summer before that. But here we are in spring. Spring is bursting out, finally. It's come again today. So can you enjoy the sunshine now that it's here? Can you enjoy the pleasure of a walk with your love in the warm summer evening? Walking through the trees? Seeing all the fresh foliage and life blossoming around you? Can you enjoy that when you try to meet this earth? Can you relax onto the ground? Feel it supporting you? Can you know that the ground is there supporting you and be with that experience? And if you do that, and you feel alive and that joy, do you find yourself wanting to share that with other people? Do you find you wanting to share that with other bugs, with other sheep, with other insects, the people that are alive today, and the people that may be alive tomorrow? Do you see in the springtime and in yourself that life just has to come out, just has to grow and burst forth? It's unstoppable, I say, that life. And I think you and I want to give that life to other people. We want to be part of that process. And how do you feel when you imagine the autumn coming after the spring, after the summer? Do you know that the days will draw in again, that the cold and the frost and the rain will come again? And the way, to put it bluntly, how does it feel to know that there's all this potential in life that we're all part of, and yet I think many of us today know that the need and the greed of today has an aspect of destroying the chances and the life of others in the future? How does it feel to awaken to that? So can we be, when we awaken to being alive, to being on this earth, to seeing all the potential that is bursting forward at this time of year, and all the potential that we are, and also to be that that will all pass away and it won't ever quite reach its full potential? Can you be with that grief and that loss, the cycle of these things, the ups and the downs? Can you be with that? And yet in that, is there still a sense of you still want to be all that you can be, and you still like to give all that you can to other people? Because I think when we awaken to ourselves, to our heart, that I think is what most of us will find. I'm very confident in that. I kind of try to temper it, saying these are just my own flights of fancy, but that's kind of what I believe and that's what I see. When we sort of look, especially here in these times, I'm kind of alluding to various environmental concerns of our times. And we find, sometimes there's a response, as well as just wanting to be all that we can do, we find ourselves wanting to fight for something, to fight to make it okay, to fight to change the environmental impacts of our time. Or do you find yourself feeling guilty that you need to take something to live? And do you feel guilty that that might destroy something for somebody else in the future? Or do you find yourself just wanting to blame somebody else for the situation? You can pick any authority figure you like, or any other part of society you like. Do you like to blame those? Do you find yourself getting angry and resentful towards those people? Or can you be with the whole breadth of the experience? All these things, I think, are going on. And I think the true kind of difficulty, the true magnificence and the true tragedy of it is that we've all got so much potential when we awaken to it, and yet it always just keeps on, it emerges and then it sort of decays away. It's so difficult to actually, in this world, reach that potential and for that to be a sustainable thing. So that's some kind of sense of what came to my mind when I thought, well, what does it mean to awaken to the green earth? What is it, this green earth awakening? To awaken to coming out into the countryside, coming to this field, being in this beautiful place, being here with each other, having some space. What can we contact? And I think often there's a sense of well-being and love, and you can get quite loved up if you're lucky, if the sun comes out and you have some nice experiences here. And I think that's put there in our hearts. That's a natural thing when you open up to the earth. You just see that so many people have got so much potential and you'd like it to exist more and more and more. And I'm drawing these parallels with the environmental concerns of our day. So that we can see the potential for life on this earth, and it's becoming increasingly obvious in modern society that it's in danger. It's really in danger. It might not be able to continue. And I just think that's an awful lot to bear in one's heart, there's no easy way around that. And I'm kind of saying I don't think it's in the nature of reality that something comes out and is perfect and just continues to unfold. There is always this, but it's imperfect. It can't quite be. It can't be forever. And I think if we're really going to awaken to ourselves, we need to awaken to that, and the tragedy of that, and the fear of that. So it's beauty and it's fear. Okay. I'm starting on another track now. I had an imagination of kind of what my life could be. Allowing myself to be open to the things that here I am. I'm alive. I've been very fortunate to be born in this country. I've had a quite incredible education. What I did with that education is another matter. But I've had an incredible education. But maybe I did lots of good things with that education. I have got good health. I've still got good health. I've turned 40 and I've still got good health. There's not that many things have gone wrong with my body. There are plenty of people who don't get to 40. There are plenty of people who kind of like, it's just not really in the societies that people have been in. You'd be dead by 35. I'm 40 and I've got good health, and I've had good health for 40 years, been able to do things with that. I've got time for leisure. I know I'm not known for not having a lot of time for leisure, but I have got time for leisure to do what I want to do in this life that I happen to have come across. My life has been full of meaningful, fulfilling creative endeavours and adventures. I mean, that's a very fortunate situation I've found myself in. I've got lots of good friends, good people to talk to, support me, love me, and I love some of them at least. I've got food. I don't seem to want for food. You know, you could hear all the disastrous things in the news. That's a lot to talk about there, isn't it? You know, sort of, the food just keeps on coming in this country. Whether the potato crop of last year was a disaster or not, we're just going to import it from somewhere else. Lucky old me. I'm just saying how fortunate I am, really, without looking at the bleak side of it for a while. So generally, I've got a good home, and I'm generally got enough of what I need. So here I am. I'm in the countryside, in this beautiful place, and I'm here engaging in, hopefully, a meaningful weekend with all of you here. What a wonderful situation to be in. And I just think, again, it's my circular bit, it's just such a natural response to want to share that with others, really. I think that is... It's just how, I think it's how all life is, quite frankly, but it's particularly how it is to be human. When you open up to all the good fortune you've had, that is what I think we'll find in our hearts. And in all this, I think there is a natural kind of thing that I can grow further on the basis of all that I've received and this situation and being alive and seeing nature around me. Everything seems to be growing and I want to grow. It's a natural thing. That's kind of in us. It's all around us when we awaken to it, and it's in everybody here. It might be growing into enjoying things more. It might be growing into just enjoying beauty more, having more pleasure. I also think it's a growing into kind of just maturing in so many kind of ways. You might be able to accept the knocks of life a bit more, have a bit more self-confidence, not be quite so dependent on the approval or disapproval of other people, whichever way you're constructed. I just think that's a natural kind of thing to find in oneself. You want to grow and you want to help other people to grow. I don't know if you all agree with me in that kind of vision of that's what life is, and that's what it's like to awaken to the earth, to awaken to life. That would be an interesting thing to talk about. But anyway, I put that out as some kind of a vision. Maybe later or sometime over the weekend we can talk about what are the kind of qualities of that kind of being that finds oneself open and aware of that within oneself. So I've already said a bit of it, but I'm going to reiterate them again. I think the kind of qualities that, you know, that life wants to grow. It's natural to find in oneself that you want to grow, that you want to reach up, as plants want to reach up. that you want just to become more than you are. Maybe it's okay to not quite be satisfied with what you find, even though it's quite an incredible thing that we all are, individually and collectively. I think it's natural, therefore, to want to become more beautiful and to want to become a stronger being. And I think implicit in all that, it's natural to be a being that wants to give to oneself and to others, to encourage others. Yeah, other kind of words in there, that one wants to be, to transcend things. That's natural to find that within oneself, in a way one wants to be free. One wants to be free of the limits that one finds within oneself. And another quality I've got here is it's natural to find, you want to change the way things are. You want to change the world. You want to improve the world. Okay. Maybe I want to point out, I'm aware, I'm kind of talking quite metaphorically here. I'm drawing a lot on, from the Buddhist tradition I'm part of, and what Sangharakshita has, his teachings in it, and sometimes people can find this sort of talk a little bit, they take it a little bit too literally. So, it's a poetic image I'm painting, please don't kind of necessarily take everything literally. Yes. So, my position here, I'm putting out, that's a natural thing that I think we will all find within ourselves if we're receptive to ourselves and the people around us, our environment.
This way.
And, I think it's, well, in some ways, when it goes, I would say, further, that is the Buddhist vision. The Buddhist vision is that one can always transcend and become more. And in Buddhism, that is represented by the image of the Buddha. We can all, in a way, become the Buddha. You might not agree with that, but I'm going to put out that sort of point of view. But I do think it's a thing that up to that point, everyone can sort of see some of that in their own hearts and the people around them. And earlier on, I was talking about the fact that there is always decay. It's never quite possible for all this to come into being, to flower and to blossom. Or at least not permanently. Again, looking at the situation, if we consume something now for ourselves, or society now consumes more and more and more, it seems inevitable that will decay. There will be people who won't have enough within that equation, or there won't be that possibility of life left in the same way in the future. In a way, it's inevitable that we have to let go of what we have, and we have to say goodbye to it. And there's that grief and there's that pain of being with that. So this again, I think, is very much part of the Buddhist teaching, and that is that there is there's this phrase in Buddhism, isn't there? It's a word of dukkha. You can translate it as pain, you can translate it like that. I think maybe that can give you slightly the wrong idea. And I have heard people get, I think, very confused by this idea that Buddhism says that there is dukkha inherent in everything. And people say, but not everything is painful, so I don't agree with that. And that's not really what I think Buddhism is saying. It's just that there are two parts of any equation. There's something growing up, the flowers and the trees grow up, we grow up, and autumn comes. And they're just part of the same equation, and it is painful to see it go away, or it's painful to think of it not being there anymore for other beings. That's an interesting thing to go and discuss, I think. What does that really mean? Can we see that in our lives? Can we relate to it? And can we also allow the pleasure in as well? Can we allow ourselves to be all that we can be, despite the fact that there's nothing permanent? It's not going to last forever. It won't be there for other beings, necessarily in the same way, I suppose. Right. How are we doing? sure I'm going to do that bit right now. So, that's one sense of what came up for me. One thought, what does it mean to awaken to the earth? Or to awaken to my heart? To awaken to being here? And I thought, well, how can we look at that in terms of what has Buddhism got to say about that kind of situation? So what struck me about it is, you know, there's this amazing potential in this whole situation, and there's also just the impossibility of it lasting, and the impossibility of, I suppose, on this earth, with environmental issues, of there being enough for everybody on the planet today, and there to be enough for there to be everybody who might be on this planet in the future. So it struck me that there's a very Buddhist image or being which really describes this situation to me, and that's of the Buddhist idea of the Bodhisattva. So earlier on I was saying we've got this Buddhist vision that we can all be, we can always transcend and become more, we can become the Buddha. And then you've got the Bodhisattva as, in some ways, another ideal within Buddhism. So we'll come to this. So on the shrine here, we've got Tara. So Tara is a Bodhisattva. The important thing is with Bodhisattvas, they step down into the world. The Buddha is somewhat, as an image, not quite on this plane of being. I know the Buddha did exist in a historical way, but a lot of the images, you might see a Buddha figure on a shrine or in an image, and it's a very ideal thing. Intentionally, it's kind of higher and loftier than we are. You know, it's a natural thing that you would look up to, that kind of image. I'm not saying you have to, but that's one way of relating to that image. So with a Bodhisattva, it's the idea that sort of the Buddhas step down and actually want to take part in this world. And you can, or beings have, taken what is known as the Bodhisattva vow. And that is, instead of saying they're going to gain enlightenment for themselves to get away from the cycle of, cycle I've been talking about things, life emerging and then it decaying away, to get away from that cycle just because they want to be free completely from that. A Bodhisattva says, I'm going to try and gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In fact, I'm not going to gain enlightenment until all beings are free from all suffering. Now and in the past and in the future, I'm not going to cease. So, and I want to do this for all of those beings. And it just seems a natural kind of figure to look at in terms of trying to do something impossible, trying to do something I thought is inconceivable. So I'm imagining that's something that is dear to a number of your hearts. We want to look after the environment, we want to give life to other beings, and we don't want to let it all be spoilt for ourselves or for this generation. It's just some huge parallel for me, like that's the work of a Bodhisattva, to use that imagery from Buddhism. So I'm going to explore that a little bit. But first of all, I thought I might just talk a bit about some images that represent Bodhisattvas in the Buddhist tradition. So I don't know if this will work for you, but there's a figure in Buddhism called Avalokiteshvara, and this Bodhisattva, he made a vow that he was going to work unceasingly for all beings, and I think he made a promise that he would shatter into pieces if for just one moment he turned away from his promise and his vow. I think the story goes something like, so he enters into a deep meditation for the good of all beings. Excuse me. I can't remember how the amount of time he meditates for is talked about. But when he enters a deep meditation and he comes out of his deep meditation, and I think he looks around, the context is Tibet, I think, that he's in, or this story is told in, and he realises not one-tenth of the beings in Tibet have kind of have gained much freedom from their practice of Buddhism, and he is just, his heart just despairs in that moment. He just realizes, I've tried so hard for all this time with my vow, and he just shatters. He literally just shatters into pieces, as was his promise. At that point, Amitabha, who we kind of met last night, in the ritual last night, Amitabha comes and puts Avalokiteshvara back together again. And he makes him into this being, and you might see this image of a being with numerous heads facing in different directions, and with numerous arms that can act in various different ways. So it can look in different directions and can act in various different ways, all at the same time. So in Buddhism, this is some kind of image for compassion, just wanting to act in different ways, with different arms, almost with different bodies, all at the same time. And that's how vast the task is, that one being thinks that they could save all beings. It's an impossible undertaking. I think that's what Avalokiteshvara in this sort of respect represents, and that it will just blow somebody apart. And that for me has a lot of resonance with well, with people burning out trying to achieve something in this world. So you might care passionately about something, and I've got this theme going on here about the environment, some environmental issue, you might campaign for it or set up something or communicate with people, and it's just very common for people to get completely exhausted by that. And I think Avalokiteshvara and compassion is more of a collective enterprise that's got many different hands all operating within the world. So that's Avalokiteshvara. Okay. I would like to return now to Tara for a little bit. So Tara, it's also just a very appropriate being to be focused upon at this time. So the story goes, there is a point in which Tara is born out of a tear or the tears of Avalokiteshvara, when he's just weeping with sorrow at really what I think I've been talking about, all the potential and all the life that there is, and all the pain that it just can't quite all be, and how is it possible to help all those beings. And out of those tears was born Tara. So I'm going to read a little something here. Just going to read something from the book by a member of the Trivatna Buddhist Order called Vasantra, Meeting the Buddhas. I just wanted to read a little bit of how he describes and introduces Tara. So he's talking about his tears pouring down as you just look at the world and all the beings, and that they pour down endlessly in response to the suffering mirrored in the tears filled in the tears. Gradually a lake of tears forms. Slowly the water in the centre of the lake are ruffled by something emerging from their depths. Out of the lake of tears rises a pastel blue lotus flower of extraordinary delicacy. A stream of tears falls into the soft heart of the lotus and transforms it into a white full moon disc. Slowly, just above the surface of the moon disc, great jade green light appears. Its outlines become more definite. Without gaining any solidity, we are watching the birth of a princess, a goddess, a bodhisattva. She is jade green in colour, clad in a rainbow skirt, with a meditation sash tied around her body. She is decked in precious jewels, bracelets, armlets, ankles, necklaces, earrings, and a tiara of gems. She is seated, her foot resting on her right thigh in meditation posture. Her right foot steps down gracefully, and as it does so, a small pastel blue lotus and moonmat arise out of the lake to make her footrest. her right arm reaches down, her and the back of her hand resting on her right knee. Her palm is open in the mudra of supreme giving. Her left hand is held out in front of her, palm outwards, the thumb and the ring finger together, so that the other three fingers point upwards. This mudra bestows protection and fearlessness through invoking the three jewels. I have to return to that. Her thumb and ring finger delicately grasp the stem of a lotus flower, which curves upwards to open into a spray of blossom by her left shoulder. There is a bud, a half-open flower, and a fully open blossom of pale blue. She is 16 years old, full-breasted, with flowing black hair. She is supremely beautiful. I hope that gives some image. I'm sure it does. Of out of tears, a beautiful being appearing and wanting to, just being there, wanting to step into the world and help. Maybe the image doesn't go all the way, but I hope it touches some of you. And Tara is just there to call upon. She is very much associated really with wanting to come into the world whenever she is called upon. So you can just say, Tara, 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 and you can know that she will come. She's a bodhisattva and she wants to come to help all beings and step down into the world. There's something, the quality, I think, that we need. Okay. I'm going to change tack again now a little bit. Staying with this idea of a bodhisattva who wants to come into the world for the sake of all beings. And I'd like to take a little bit of time to explore from the Buddhist tradition the path or the life of a bodhisattva is sometimes described in six perfections. These can describe a path or the qualities that a bodhisattva has, or are the ideal qualities of a bodhisattva. So I'm interested in looking at this because I think many of us here want to help other beings and want to help ourselves, whether it's looking at the environment, looking at nature, or whether we're looking at where Buddhism is maybe looking more at the growth of an individual and how we can grow ourselves. I just thought this would be a useful little framework to look at. You could take them away, think about these qualities. I think they're what Buddhism says, these qualities are necessary if you really want to grow yourself and to help other beings in this world. So I'll list them first and then I'll talk a bit about them. So there is generosity. There's that as a quality to develop and to practice. There is being moral and ethical, that a bodhisattva would be moral and ethical. There is patience. The quality of patience is needed. And there is energy. And it's translated as energy in pursuit of the good. The bodhisattva needs a lot of energy. Then there is the quality of meditation or concentration that the bodhisattva has to develop. And there is to have wisdom. So I'll talk a bit about all of those. And the other thing to say is that the bodhisattva tries to perfect these things. Firstly, that's the process, there is always more of them to be brought into being. And it's also that these things have a sort of a manifestation more in the here and now, in the world, you might call it, in a mundane way. And there is also an aspect of uh, how to word it. A lot of it goes on, yeah, a lot of these things are to do with not identifying so much with me. That when I act in the world, I'm doing it for me. That's how I view it. All these things, as they're increasingly perfected, there's an, you know, that one would become just as concerned with the other beings around you. If you're trying to give something to another being, you wouldn't get into the sense of, this is me giving this person a present, what a good guy I am, how clever of me to realise that somebody else needed this gift. That in the perfection of them, there would just be a flow of just giving and receiving without particularly being bothered about the who of it. So there's always that aspect of these kind of things. So generosity, just to look at generosity. This all gets a bit, you get into lists when you start to read up on this thing, and I find that a little bit difficult actually. By which I mean it tends to be, it starts to move a bit away from my experience, and I kind of like to talk from my experience really. So maybe I'll just pick some of the things out of this list. Some of you will recognise some of this. So giving, that involves different beings. It involves giving to other beings. That's very much what we're talking about, and it's a practice. It's a Buddhist practice, trying to get away from yourself. And we all need each other in this respect. It's the interplay between us all and all the other beings that might ever be on this planet. So you give to other beings is really what I'm saying. And then there is a question of what do you give? There are... Why not just read this list from the Buddhist tradition and from Bante? You can just give material things. You can just give objects. That's one thing you can give. And this list is in a hierarchy, apparently. Then you could give fearlessness. This is one of the ones that always strikes me... the most. It always makes me kind of give it a double take, really. That is a gift that we could give to each other. God, it makes me think, I'm just quite prone to anxiety, and I find it quite humbling and humiliating that sometimes, a lot of the time, I don't have that gift of fearlessness to give to other people around me. In fact, I might be giving quite the opposite, and that has quite an effect, as some of you might know. But it's the idea is present within us. Look, God, one could be confident. One could know that it could go right and it could go wrong, and one could just fearlessly give that confidence. It's like, actually, I'm not bothered. I'm just going to try. You know, and on that level, it doesn't really matter if it all decays and falls away or not. One could be confident in that. You know, life will come around again, I suppose. Or not, hey? You could debate that. Even then, you could still be fearless, and maybe that is the environmental situation, the existential situation. You know, in this period of time, you know, the climate change thing, it keeps on changing. The news keeps on going that it's just going to get worse and worse. Now, maybe all those predictions aren't right, but maybe they are. Maybe in 50 years' time, other beings won't be able to live like this. But maybe, as the Bodhisattva does, we should just try anyway, fearlessly, despite the fact that it, in some ways, is pointless. I think we should try and do that. I think that's kind of what fearlessness is. You know, you might know that it's just impossible, and the task is just too vast. It can never work, but you'll do that anyway. Other interesting things on this list are education. I'm not sure I'm going to talk about that very much. There's plenty to say about it, though. The next one is very interesting. Life and limb. That you can give life and limb. Wow. That's very interesting, isn't it? Yet we could all go and... we could all kind of give ourselves to other beings that really need... things maybe more than we do. I don't really think that would often be a very wise scenario. Maybe it's important to know that you could give life and limb, and maybe many of us do. Maybe many of us in some ways give our lives. We've got our life now and we give what we have got until we haven't got it anymore. You could get a bit more dramatic than that. You know, that is possible, isn't it? But the point that struck me as I was reading about this is that if you're going to kind of give your life away, which is an incredibly, incredibly precious thing, you would have to be incredibly confident that it's going to be even more beneficial to the beings you're giving it to than if you took your life and gave all the other things you could give, or had all the rest of that life for yourself. And that's one hell of a question, really, isn't it? So anyway, I don't want to get hung up on this because we get the wrong idea, and I'm not advocating that we go about thinking about giving life and limb. It's just in a list, really. I'll finish the list, goes into giving away merit. Buddhism is quite sometimes into this idea that if you do good deeds, you gain merit, and that you can give it away. I don't really believe in merit in that way, personally, but it's an okay idea, and there's plenty of mileage in it. But I'm into the idea of giving it away. I'm also into the idea of kind of like accumulating good fortune for oneself that you might well need, you know? But if you have got plenty of merit, that you've done many good things, in some ways you can ritually, imaginatively give that away to other beings. And that's a thing that I know a lot of us who are Buddhists often do, ritually say things to try and imagine doing that. I think we could imagine it a lot more quite often. And the other thing, the final thing you can give, I'm not sure about that last word. Another thing you can give is to give the Dharma, which is to give the truth. So within Buddhism, we're saying, you know, try to talk about what it is like to practice. Try to elucidate what that means and how to do that. And that is probably one of the best gifts you could give to anybody else. I suppose in some ways what it's saying is you could tire yourself out trying to save the planet for other beings, but maybe the thing is to help other beings who could help other beings, or you could help other beings to be more content, to not consume as much. You can't do it all yourself in some ways, I think, is a lot of what is in that. Okay, so that's a whole load about generosity, and I think I'd better keep moving on. And the second thing is to be ethical. The Bodhisattva developed a perfection of being ethical. And I came across, just a little phrase struck me, that it's just, I just don't often think about it this way, really. It just struck me that ethics is the expression of metta. Ethics is the expression of love. It just strikes me as that's so obviously what it is. The problem is, when we mention that we've got to be moral or good or to be ethical, I think it's very easy to get into thinking that somebody is telling you what you should do, and that you will be judged on this criteria. Particularly prevalent in our society. I find it in me all the time. I'm always wanting, really, the approval of some authority figure and to do what they are telling me to do. That's deep within my psyche. You might find it's the other way around in your psyche, that you want to tell the authority exactly where they can go. It's all much part of the same loop, I think. But there's this other way of looking at it, and I hope you can get there, that when you open your heart, so you open to the earth and you open to being alive, it is natural to want to act with love, and all ethics come out of love. It can be a bit tricky then that Buddhism kind of has some formulations of some ethical precepts. You have 5 precepts, you have 10 precepts, or possibly other lists of things, which it kind of says if you do these things you will probably find that your life and the life of other people that you meet will probably turn out better. It's very helpful advice. But it's not a list of rules, and I think it comes out of, well, I think really it comes out of the experience of an enlightened being, and within this framework, like the more we are open to our hearts, and are open to what it means to be alive, then I think the more we have a spirit of that. So I see it very much as a natural thing. But I do want to say something else about ethics, which is, so the Buddha has gone to the length of trying to describe some ways in which it is helpful to behave, you know, which is to have deeds of loving kindness, open-handed generosity, I'm going to get it all wrong now, stillness, simplicity and contentment, to be truthful and helpful and harmonious in your speech, and then we get into being aware, to generate awareness and not to be intoxicated, and to work on your mind. We can look at that list some other time. You'll find it. I'm not really going to go into it too much. But there's this crucial thing I like to talk about here. It's just the Buddha has seen, this is a tradition, that there is a law of karma in the universe. And that is, if you act in a certain way, that will generate the kind of being you become in the future. Your actions have consequences on who you are. It's just the same. It's not as scientific as the law of gravity. It doesn't have a set of equations which happen to fit into a mathematical framework. But it is a law of the universe, nevertheless. If you act in loving ways, certain states of mind follow. And if you act out of hatred, for example, in the opposite, certain states of mind tend to arise. So it's not that anybody is telling you what to do and judging you, and it's just so easy to get into that. What I'm trying to say is this astounding thing that the Buddha has tried to express. There is a law in the universe. If you act in these ways, that law will work in your favour and the favour of other people around you. You will become a more loving, confident, helpful, bright being. That's his advice. And he's not saying, well, it might be like that. He's saying, this is a law of the universe. I think that is staggeringly difficult to accept, to hear what he's saying there, what is being said. So that's why I want to try and say it. It's really worth thinking about what Buddhism is saying about ethics. Say it again. It's not judgmental. No one's telling anyone what to do. It comes out of the heart, and it will help you and other beings. Whether or not we all agree about that is another subject, which I think we should talk about a lot. I think that would be very, very helpful and a worthwhile thing to do. There you go. Anyway, these are one of the qualities, if you want to help other beings, that the Buddhist tradition says you could try and develop. The next one, patience. I don't have anywhere near as much to say about that, except for one requires patience. It's no... It's exactly like it says it is. That's what you need. I don't think we tend to get that wrong by what we might mean by patience. You really overheating, Akashi?
Yeah,
I was going
to pause, just carry on.
Oh, okay.
A little bit more air.
Yeah. Is everyone okay?
A bit more air.
Well, it's been going on for a while, haven't you? Been slowly wilting. Maybe do something. I'm doing.
Excited.
Hooray! Thank you, everybody. So, all that's come up for me in terms of patience that I thought I'd want to express is just to bring back to my experience. What is it like for me? I just get so frustrated with that. I'm trying to do something, I'm trying to achieve something, trying to bring something into being. I've poured loads of myself into it, maybe year after year after year, and it just doesn't go the way I had hoped or intended it would go. And you know, that somehow brings patience into focus for me. It's not some small, easy thing. You know, what does it mean if you've poured your whole self into trying to achieve something in your life and it just dissolves in your hands, or it just kind of goes off in some other direction? You know, what can you do? It's very natural to be very frustrated. You could get angry. You could get into all kind of other mental states, but you could go, oh, yes, this just requires that I gather myself and I try again. I keep on engaging. So, yeah, it's a koan for me. What does it mean to engage passionately in something with all of one's being and really be okay if it doesn't really work? And I find that excruciatingly painful. And it just brings out the quality of patience, really, just being able to sit with that and go, okay, well, I'm sure it will have some positive consequences somewhere down the line, but I don't know where, and maybe it's not now. Maybe it's not, hasn't brought out what I need and other people need right now. But patience. These things will all come about if one acts ethically, I suppose, and acts with good intentions. The next quality, which in some ways is an interesting juxtaposition to patience, that one needs energy, absolutely huge quantities of energy. And we have this definition, this word energy in pursuit of the good, and it just hangs there. What on earth do we mean by the good? Really hard to define, really, but we can put it out there. But this idea that the bodhisattva in the bodhisattva's giving never gets tired. It's something about this kind of quality of energy. It is so engaged, it's such playful energy that wants to engage, wants to do more and more and more. So, like, the more you do of it, the more energy you get back, is a quality of this kind of energy. So it's not a forced energy, again, which burns out. It's difficult to know where that comes from. And again, people talk about it not being one's own energy, I suppose. It's a thing that you might engage in. There is a huge well of energy in this world, and it's like we can kind of tap into it and kind of become part of that and let it emerge. I would say, my thing is by engaging with lots of other people in order to achieve something. That's how I make sense of it. You know, so, for example, for me, within Butterfield, I've loved being part of something where there is so much energy. I've not got the energy to create a smallest part of what we do here in Butterfield, but it's something about lots and lots of people coming together, and you can experience a huge flow of energy that doesn't tire out. Maybe it does tire out, but anyway, we can talk about that. So that's something about the quality of energy, ceaseless energy, that keeps on replenishing itself that is needed. The fifth quality that the bodhisattva has is concentration or meditation. So I don't see that there's much point in me talking a lot about that. The place to explore that is by going and trying to learn to meditate. Of which there is a lot of good advice out there, and hopefully a lot of opportunities, and opportunities this weekend. So I'm not really going to say anything about that. The only point that struck me about it is this point that a bodhisattva, a being that wants to save all beings, needs to go and meditate. That there is a need to go off into a solitary space, a space where you can go deeper within yourself. You can look at yourself, become aware of yourself, develop kindness within yourself, develop awareness, and allow yourself to go deeper and deeper into that concentration and that process, and let that transform oneself. You know, you can't go out into the world and give and give and give without having this, a relationship with this, some time for this in one's life. Oh, I thought that was a very interesting point. And then finally we've got the point that the bodhisattva develops wisdom, which one goes, what on earth can I say about that, really? It's kind of this point at which I'm talking about the idea of transcending me or transcending other, or the idea of transcending all concepts. And I could talk about that for a while. I'm not sure I would say anything particularly meaningful. You know, we could it's really just dip off into ideas. There. I'm kind of sorry about that. I'd love to have more to say about it, but it's a bit that way. Things that we could go and look at is when we do pujas together, you know, quite often in sevenfold puja, there's the Heart Sutra is recited. And that is, you could go and recite that if you wanted to know a little bit more about what's been said here. That's one way of angling at it. I kind of wanted to return a little bit to coming into contact with the earth and coming into contact with meeting other people as a way of experiencing wisdom. So why I like doing things with other people as a practice is that if I spent all my time by myself, I mean, maybe I just wouldn't want to do that anyway, but I think I would just carry on seeing things the way I like to see them. I've got my views of the world, the way that Satchajit likes it. He likes marmalade on his toast. He also likes peanut butter and Marmite. And likes porridge this way and not that way. I think people should do this. I think people shouldn't do that. I think this is a good idea. I think that's a bad idea. I like that bit. I don't like that bit. And when I come and do things with other people, quite frankly, I just can't maintain my views. Other people just want to do things other ways, and it is bloody infuriating, quite frankly. I wish you would stop doing it. And that is why it's so good, isn't it? You can't, if you want to transcend your sense of me, go and meet other people. If you want to engage with wisdom and to move beyond self and other and concepts, just engage with other. Engage with the world, really. So it brings right back to engage with life. Engage with the planet, engage with life, trying to come up, engage with other beings, care about other beings, be interested in what is in it for them and the potential in them, as well as have you got what you need. And I think that is a very appropriate way of trying to develop wisdom, you know. Wisdom isn't a thing, I think, that you can particularly get by reading the Heart Sutra a lot of times. You might, it might all click into focus. Great, please tell someone about it if it does. But I think if I, you know, it just can't be switched on, can it? But I think engaging with something which is going to challenge what you want and your conceptions of yourself and what your likes and dislikes are is likely to result in quite a lot of wisdom somewhere down the road if you keep on doing it. There's no time scale in which it may or may not emerge. But it's here as a quality that one needs to engage with if you want to give to other beings. If that's the Buddhist tradition, that quality needs to be there. Now, that's pretty much all I've got to say, and I've been going on for an hour now, so I need to wrap up fairly soon. I'm going to finish with a few verses. Again, we're looking at the Bodhisattva. There is, in the Buddhist tradition, in the history of it all, you might come across this book, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Shantideva. It's a fantastic text, and it looks at all the qualities of a Bodhisattva in various ways. And you can take it literally, and you can take it as poetry, and you can do your head either way, in my opinion, by looking at that. I've known people have read it and they just, it drives them nuts because it contradicts itself all over the place when they take it as a piece of logic. But it's also poetry trying to invoke these different qualities of giving, of ethics, of meditation, of wisdom. So I just wanted to, a few verses about what it means to a Bodhisattva trying to give to other beings. Where shall I start? May I be the doctor and the medicine, and may I be the nurse for all sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. May a rain of food and drink descend to clear away the pain and thirst and hunger, and during the aeon of famine, may I myself change into food and drink. May I become an inexhaustible treasure for those who are poor and destitute. May I turn into all things they could need, and may these be placed close beside them. going to stop there. Mm.